Welcome. Welcome to the Unitarian Universalist Fellowship of Manhattan. Regardless of where you come from, regardless of who you came with, or who you leave with, you are welcome in our community. Ours is a welcoming community. We hope that you all feel and share with us the same sense of community. You're welcome here. And speaking of community, my first announcement is after this morning's service is our annual meeting. So all are welcome to attend, where we will discuss the future of the fellowship. Are there other announcements? No? Okay. So where is Jake? Jake is. That's time to nudge him. As practice in UU fellowships around our land, we light this chalice to help guide us today, tomorrow, and for all the days to come. So please rise as you are able, or join us in song for number 108, which I don't have in front of me, which is "My Life Flows On in Endless Song." Anybody said it yet, but you guys sound really great. Sitting up here, you guys sound really good. This is the portion of our service where we share the joys and the sorrows that we've felt, both personally and in our family and in our communities over the last week. So please wait for the microphone, which is being circulated, and speak.
Sybil Perkins. First, I'm going to tell on Dave. I had a concern this week, but it's turned into a joy. The concern is he was in a bicycle accident, resulted in a trip to the hospital in an ambulance and some amnesia. So the concussion, but the joy is that he seems to be doing pretty well. I I also have a joy. Congratulations to the Banner family. I believe, isn't it this weekend that Eric Banner is being installed as a UU minister in Golden, Colorado.
Morning. I'm Kathleen Oldfather, and I got the sad news of the morning to report. And when I was carrying chair, there were several people I kind of watched over, and two of those people died just recently. And one was Don Davis, who was a member here for a long time, Don and Jean Davis. Not extremely active, but he helped build this stage, so I always think of him. And then Phoebe Samuelson just died, too. And Phoebe's daughter and I have for years gone back and forth, you know, watching over each other's moms and talking about them, how's your mom and my mom. And it's unbelievable that they died within 2 weeks of each other after all this time. But I don't think Karen's coming today. But anyway, think of them. I have no dates for services. Phoebe's maybe Tuesday at Meadowlark. So watch for that. Okay.
Hi, Mark Clark. My joy is on kind of a global scale. Yesterday was Earth Day, and there were March for Science events all over the country and support for those marches around the world. There might have even been others around the world. But anyway, I went to Kansas City. I chose to go there to kind of get a lot of bang for my buck, and it was pretty impressive. The police estimated 5,000 people. There weren't when I was there, but there were people coming and going all day, and it was amazing. A lot of people from on the national scale came to there, a lot of local doctors, scientists, et cetera, and a lot of enthusiasm for the sciences. And us as UUs understand that that's important, and I hope that serves as a message to all of us that we need to keep that in the forefront so we don't get further behind as a nation but also as a world and kind of lose everything we've got. So thanks.
Hi, Ann Marchin. I'm kind of going to be splitting my residencies between here and Kansas City. I've got a house that I put a contract on it, and we'll see if the inspections come through. But anyway, I have my kids out here this weekend helping me pack and getting my roots pulled up. Literally dug up a lot of plants to take with me to Kansas City. So anyway, I've seen a lot of people come and go here, and I'm kind of going, but I'll still be coming back. So anyway, I wanted to share that. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. For all those joys and concerns that lighten our hearts or burden our hearts yet remain unspoken, we ask that you find peace here to help you. Thank you. We will now hear from the choir. In the room. So there's one. There's another one. So anybody who's small or wants to be, come on up. And I'm taking the easy way out, and I'm going to read a book. And it's called Rosalind Rutabaga and the Biggest Hole on Earth. One day, Rosalind woke up, and if I can find the page, she woke up with a great plan. And her plan for that day was to build the biggest hole on Earth. She was really excited. So she ran downstairs, she got dressed, maybe not in that order, ran downstairs, and had breakfast with her dad. And her father said, "What are your plans for today?" And she said, "I'm going to build the biggest, or dig the biggest hole on Earth." And he says, "Well, that's great. Where are you going to go?" And she says, "Well, maybe I'll make it all the way to the South Pole." And he says, "Be sure to take a sweater because I've heard it's really cold down there." So she runs out in the backyard with a shovel and with a sweater because she might end up at the South Pole. And looks around the backyard and decides not to dig in his flower garden. I don't know where it is up there. Not to dig in his flower garden, in her dad's flower garden. And not to dig next to the oak tree because there are lots of roots and it's kind of hard to dig. Not to dig over by the rocks because it's rocky. So she finds a perfect spot to start digging. And she's going to dig the biggest hole on Earth.
Right there.
Yeah, right there, where it says here. Well, the trouble with that is she starts digging. And the first thing she hears is she starts digging. And the first thing she hears is a, "Whoa! Stop it." And she's digging in the front yard of a worm. And the worm says, "You can't dig here. This is my front yard. What do you think you're doing? Go find someplace else." So she says, "Sorry, sorry, sorry, sorry." And she goes and finds another place to start digging. So she doesn't dig there. Whoops. She goes somewhere else and starts digging. And she digs a couple of inches down. And here's another voice. And it's not the worm's voice, but it's a mole's voice. And the mole says, "Stop digging here. This is my bedroom. What are you doing?" So she stops digging, and she finds another spot. And he says, and he grumbles and grumbles and grumbles and goes back to sleep. Down here, I think is where he is. He goes back to sleep, and she's digging another place. So she digs and digs and digs. She finds another spot, digs and digs and digs the biggest hole on earth, and stumbles across some bones. And she's sure she has found a bone from a dinosaur. And she's sure that the bone she found was the, what was it? Triceratops big toe bone. You forgot the big toe part. So she was sure it was a big toe bone from a triceratops. But as she's sitting there looking, admiring her bone, a dog comes up and says, "Hey, I just buried that bone. And I got it from the butcher last week, and I know he doesn't sell dinosaur bones. So it's not a dinosaur bone. It's a whatever it was he got at the butcher shop. So dig somewhere else." So at this point, she decides she needs a rest. So she just lies in the bottom of her hole. It's a very deep hole at this point, but she just lies in the bottom, gives up her idea of going to the South Pole. Her father comes along and says, "Are you down there? Are you down there, Rosalind?" Because it is a very deep hole. And her father says, "Well, are you ready for lunch? Are you hungry?" And she says, "Yeah, I'm ready for lunch now." So her plans change a little bit, and they have lunch in their hole, in the hole that she dug. But she says to bring a sweater because it's awfully cold down here. So he brings a sweater, and they have lunch down there in the hole. And the moral of the story, what do you think the moral of the story is?
Digging a hole?
That's the subject. Yeah, thank you. Yeah. Never give up, because she did dig a big hole. It wasn't the biggest hole on earth, and she didn't go all the way to the South Pole, but she never gave up. But her decision to dig that hole affected the worm, the mole, the dog, and eventually it would have affected the penguins. So you need to consider what is going to happen with her decision or your decision. So that's the moral of the story. So,
go now, our hearts go with you. Go enjoy our hopes, go to learn in love and grow in wisdom. Shine your light in all you do. Go in love, our hearts go with you. Go in love, our hearts go to.
So now we ask for your generosity in sharing your bounty with the fellowship. Thank you, Matthew. And thank you, John Lennon. We will now sing, and stand if you're able, to sing number 90, hymn number 90, From All the Fret and Fever of the Day. In introducing John Alou's speech or talk this morning, my reading is going to be from the Constitution of the Iroquois Nations, which was the Great Building Law. This is an undated constitution, but apparently served as the basis for much of what is written in the U.S. Constitution, with a few exceptions, such as consideration of future generations, which was included in Section 28, which I will read. In all of your deliberations, and this is a quote, in all of your deliberations in the Confederate Council, in your efforts at lawmaking, in all your official acts, self-interest shall be cast into oblivion. Cast not behind you the warnings of your nephews and nieces, should they chide you for any error or wrong you may do, but return to the way of the great law, which is just and right. Look and listen for the welfare of the whole people, and have always in view not only the past and the present, but also the coming generations, the unborn of the future nation. These words are the basis for considering the seventh generation in all of our decision making. What are the impacts on our children and their children and the children of our children and so forth to seven generations? It also ties in with the seventh principle of the Unitarian Universalist, which reads, respect for the interdependent web of all existence of which we are a part. I also have a quote from Edward Abbey, who is one of my favorite authors of the moment. And you can read this any way you want, but I like the words that he wrote. Wilderness is not a luxury, but a necessity of the human spirit, and is vital to our lives as water and good bread. John Luke, please.
So we're going to begin this morning in my reflection with a couple reflections from you. I've got a couple of assistants, my lovely Vannas. One of the first exercises that I ever encountered in community organizing was a simple one where we brainstormed the differences between the world as it is and the world as it should be. And so we're going to do that right now. So I would like you to tell me some things that are differences that they could put up on the world as it is and the world as it should be. It's doubled. I'm a good planner. I've done this before.
Springboat, well, for one thing, it's polluted. So
world as it is polluted.
Yeah.
World as it should be.
It's not as bad as it was before, but it's still polluted.
Okay.
there is a lot of income inequity that I think could be fixed without too much trouble if people were willing to do it.
Income inequity. Income equity.
And the world as it should be is shared with all creatures. Shared. The world as it is dominated by human.
Shared with all creatures, dominated by humans, maybe even sometimes dominated by particular humans.
The world as it is has a whole lot of injustice and violence, and the world as it should be would be a lot more peaceful and just.
Okay.
Gerrymandering to subvert democracy.
Gerrymandering to subvert democracy. I'm guessing that's the world as it is. So democracy is the world as it should be. Okay.
The world as it is, we don't have health care for everyone, only for the wealthy. And I think the world as it should be, that should be a human right given to everyone.
Okay. Health care.
The world as it is has many hungry people.
Hunger.
Hunger, that's a good one.
Mm.
And fed.
Fed.
Very good.
The world as it is overpopulated, and the world as it should be is rightly populated.
Okay, overpopulated and rightly populated. Larry's had his hand up a while, too.
The world as it is has many places that are on the verge or involved in war.
Mm-hmm.
And as it should be, would be peaceful.
War and peace. And we'll let Larry have the last one, I think.
The world as it is in the world as it is, women's place is typically undervalued, and in the world as it should be, that would turn around.
Is patriarchal okay?
Misogynistic?
Patriarchal is probably preferable.
And she's just going to keep getting worse if you...
Don't get me going.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Mark. Thank you, everybody. This is not nearly everything. The world as it is different from the world as it should be. And some people believe that the vision of the world as it should be comes from some authoritative source like that spells out the rules for us. They long for a paradise, a Garden of Eden, a religious model that encapsulates all that's good. And we UUs don't have an image like that, but we can still have an image of the world as it should be that's based on our imagination. But one of the things is that it's based on an imperfect human imagination. Our imaginings of the world are limited by having been raised and grown up in the world as it currently is. So we can't even imagine some of what the world should be. And so one of the first things that we have to do when we consider the world as it should be is our own limitations. And I would argue that to make any of the changes that need to be made, we have to have a multi-layered attack. Yes, we have to change the practices and policies of government and corporations. We also have to change the policies and practices of organizations. and even families that we're a part of. And we have to change our own hearts and minds, the way we live. So the old song, "Let there be peace on earth and let it begin with me," has a point. If I cannot practice peace in my life, how am I ever going to help bring it into the world? Similarly, second wave feminists had a slogan, "The personal is the political." Changes in our personal lives affect our political, may lead to political change, and changes in politics affect our personal lives. They're one and the same in many ways. And we could certainly make that case for working on the environment, that there are changes that we have to make as individuals, as well as changes in the government policies and that kind of thing. Now, I'm not saying that it's enough to change our personal lives. In fact, that's an over-focus on individualism and a desertion of commitment to the interdependent web. Changes have to come at all levels, personal, institutional, political, legal, cultural. And some of the gaps between the world as it is and the world as it should be can best be dealt with collectively through the political system, and others are best tackled in other ways. And all modes of transformation are legitimate. Often, though, in order to even begin to envision the world as it should be, we have to limit the influence of the world as it is on our own selves. And I can't think of a better example for talking through the interconnectedness of these levels than around race and white supremacy. And besides that, a group of Black UU colleagues have encouraged UUs to have a teach-in around white supremacy, and they've actually encouraged that over the next couple of weeks. And so I thought today I'd do some of that teach-in sort of thing as we are talking about changing the world, and I hope we can have some follow-up to it later. Before I go there, though, I have to make an observation or two about our particular fellowship in our particular location. And one thing I'd note is that we didn't really talk about the inequality among humans a lot here. When I was preparing to come to this congregation a couple years ago and proudly posted on Facebook our beautiful video about UUFM, one of the Facebook comments I got was, "Why is it so white?" Because it reflects who we are, as uncomfortable as that may make us. The census tells me that Manhattan is 80% non-Hispanic white. UU congregations overall are 91.5% white. Our fellowship is whiter than either, more in the 99% range, though I'm embarrassed to say that I don't know whether we have more than one member who identifies as a person of color, and I'm aware that we can't always know by looking. UU congregations are among the many that tend toward de facto racial segregation, even while we champion diversity. That's one of those cliques, how we're not how we should be, how we're not how we aspire to be. On the question of comfort and discomfort around these topics, UU activist and Board of Trustees members Christina Rivera has said, "If you're doing anti-racism work and you're comfortable, you're doing it wrong." So today, I'm trying to push past my comfort level and probably yours. I'm trying to look at things that are painful. I would say, though, that this applies particularly to white people. The work on this issue needs to come from white people, so that's where the discomfort most likely lies. And if you are a person of color listening this morning, know that we're trying to do better, and we're willing to be uncomfortable to do so. So, everyone keep breathing and stay with me if you can. So ends my aside. So why bring up white supremacy now? There are 100 other focuses I could have around transformation this morning, including the certainly calendrically appropriate. Is that a word? Calendrically appropriate to the calendar. One of Earth Day and climate change, which is huge. But this focus on white supremacy is particularly appropriate right now for Unitarian Universalists. And you may have heard that a recent hiring decision in the UUA prompted people to consider why, after 25 years after we committed to making our UUA racially diverse and multicultural institution, we have made so little progress toward that goal. I remember the excitement around that resolution of immediate witness in 1992 in Calgary, Canada. I was not very involved with the extensive politicking around it, but I was a member of the UUs for Lesbian and Gay Concerns. Remember, this was back before we used the word queer or understood the need for inclusion of bisexual and transgender people. And our group, UUs for Lesbian and Gay Concerns, voted to endorse the resolution. And I cried when I voted for that resolution. It felt like we were really doing something that mattered. 5 years later, we got more specific and formal, calling for an anti-racist and multicultural organization. So I'm personally disappointed and frustrated, even as I realize that I have not stayed focused enough on this. So why have we made so little progress toward an anti-racist, multicultural UUA? I could go into the inside politics here, either today's or that of the 1970s, and that might be useful, but nobody really wants to hear that. If you really do want to know, I've got a stack of books over there I can lend you. So, I have a simpler answer. Our progress has been limited by white supremacy. And when most of us hear the term white supremacy, we think of men in white robes burning crosses, or maybe their contemporary descendants, alt-right champions like Richard Spencer and Breitbart News. These are folks who consciously and deliberately promote the idea that whites ought to be in charge. And sometimes they go so far as to promote violence in order to get their goals. And these white supremacists openly admit that they believe white people are better than others, and they make no apology for it. Now, most of us would argue against that thesis, focusing on how we're all really alike, which is a concept that might be equally false. Blurring differences that matter in the personal and political realms. We find ourselves caught up in a society that sees white as the default human being, particularly white, able-bodied, cisgender, heterosexual men, but definitely white. And the non-default, the non-white, well, not as much attention, credibility, or influence. And what's more, the world as it is gives power and priority to white people, to their culture, goals, and wants. And that phenomenon, which is white supremacy, is behind the centuries-long colonization and extermination of Native American people here on this continent, as well as in South America, Australia, and Africa. It's behind the slave labor economy, which is an economy that still holds on in some ways, for example, in the prison system, and even in the need to defend the very idea of a minimum wage. It's behind the nationalism that screams build a wall and identifies undocumented immigrants by appearance and accent, leaving Canadian and Irish immigrants alone while discriminating against citizens who look or sound un-American. Plus, it does a whole lot more subtle stuff. White supremacy is the water we swim in. We don't even see it because it's part of our expectations. Now, definitions can be useful, especially for something that has as many tentacles as white supremacy does. Elizabeth Martinez has defined it as a historically based, institutionally perpetuated system of exploitation and oppression of continents, nations, and peoples of color by white peoples and nations of the European continent for the purpose of maintaining and defending a system of wealth, power, and privilege. Now, that captures the systemic nature of white supremacy, but it might cast it as too historical, maybe too big, while it lives and breathes today in our lives. Crossroads Anti-Racist Collective uses a definition more focused on internalized racist superiority in their definition of white supremacy. They call it a complex, multi-generational socialization process that teaches white people to believe, accept, and or live out superior societal definitions of self, to fit into and live superior social roles. And these behaviors define and normalize the race construct and its outcome. So it's that socialization process that keeps us baffled and unable to move forward and accounts for what has happened or hasn't happened in the last 25 years or so. For comparison, historian and theologian Mark Morrison Reed points out that in 1967, 27% of UUs thought that a black minister's race might hamper their performance. That's a big chunk, more than a quarter of UUs. Now, we wouldn't see that figure today. However, in 1967, that same year, almost half, 47% of UUs thought that a woman's gender might hamper her as a minister. Today, more than half of our ministers are women. And the idea that of that being a problem is rarely expressed out loud, even though sexism has not been eradicated from our ranks. And at the same time, we have only about 30 African-American ministers, which is a very small percentage of our ministers. So in 1989, 26% of UUs still thought that race would hamper a black minister. About the same as 22 years earlier, but 66%, two-thirds, thought that being gay or lesbian would. We have now over 70 LGBTQ ministers, more than twice the number of black ministers we have. Heterosexism hasn't died either, but we're doing better on that than we are on race. There are a few other ministers of color, East Indians, Native Americans, and Latinx, but their numbers are tiny, and many of our professionals of color struggle ending their careers with negotiated resignations or quitting in frustration. Now, I use these statistics on ministry because they're available. There are a lot of other ways that we could look at white supremacy within our ranks, but I have these numbers, so I think they're useful to look at. And what's clear is that something in our UU cultural context keeps us from being able to make the changes we need when it comes to racialized culture. Now, of course, that's not just UUs. Yesterday, I read an account of the way issues of race and privilege came to the fore with organizers of yesterday's Science March. People of color are pointing out that decisions about who gets funded in science have always been political decisions. And to claim that a march is not political is lying to ourselves. The issues in the scientific community are so like the issues in Unitarian Universalism, or anywhere else, I guess, in white supremacist culture, that I could have been reading a blog post from one of our people about UUs. 20 years ago, a white woman I know, Sarah Cook, wrote a story of a kingdom of circles and triangles, where triangles had long ruled, and they decided to become a democracy, and she tells about a circle that tries to get a good job, and it's confronted by this panel of three triangle interviewers who are biased against rolling. They think rolling is a useless skill. And they're insistent that exactly three sides to every issue must be seen. And the circle, desperately trying to get the job, tells itself and the panel that it could learn about that kind of balance and perspective, but of course it doesn't get the job. We can see how those factors line up with circle when it circles in triangles, and it's harder to see our own biases and preconceptions, the factors that favor whites in our society. And this piece about context is significant. Being part of a culture of white supremacy does not make us individually white supremacists, nor does it mean we need to feel guilt around our culture. If we do too much of that, we become ineffective, reactive, and defensive. And we do so much better if we can remain open and curious. So we have to acknowledge the reality of the effects and the work to change the causes while not beating ourselves up about it. First, we have to learn to see what we have been taught not to see, what seems normal, our balance and three-sidedness, so to speak. As a young adult, I learned a lot about my hometown of Manassas, Virginia, when I had lived in an even more racist environment in Danville, Virginia. When I came home, I noticed and realized things I had not seen and understood before. Exposure to different environments does that, expands our sensibilities. Also, listening when others try to point out what they see and experience, even when I don't see it at first, when I don't understand it at first. I've spent some time with a list of characteristics of white supremacy culture that Kenneth Jones and Tima Okun developed. The full list is available online, and you can I have a list of resources here that I'll have available if people want to take them, and this is on there. So anyway, a few of them particularly stood out for me, and as I share these, listen for how you've seen these characteristics play out. If you can, think of how they might be limiting and how abandoning them or playing them down might change everything. Power hoarding. When we think of how white Europeans conquered the world, this is obvious. Hoarding power sets up a competitive battle where others are seen as enemies rather than as potential allies. It stymies coalitions and teamwork because we're suspicious that someone will get credit for my work or will make decisions I disagree with. We have trouble pooling our resources to do things together because we might not be so important to the effort. It causes breakups of institutions when leaders compete for power. People with power feel threatened by suggestions of change when power is hoarded. Second one, individualism. Because we as white people do not have strong collective identities, we tend to value individual competition over cooperation. We see ourselves as distinct and different, missing our similarities and shared cultural values, and we can end up isolated. Objectivity. Our Enlightenment values have left us over-focused on the objective and measurable. Too often we think that anything that is of value can be put into measurable terms. So we denigrate intuition and emotions, not seeing them as valid paths to decision-making. And this may push us toward quantity over quality. Giving priority to the written word. Written narratives appear more authoritative than spoken stories. Literacy is seen as a key indicator of intelligence. Documentation determines whether something is believable. And the last one I'll share with you this morning is fear of open conflict. People who are in power do not like conflict because it could challenge them. The focus is on being polite. We might call it Kansas nice. Okay, breathe again. That's only a few, but it's enough to think about right now. Imagine if we could see conflict as an opportunity to learn about another point of view. Imagine if we could give oral presentations and visual arts the same authority as the written word. Imagine if we could claim different ways of knowing that don't translate to objective statistics. Imagine if we could work together with trust and learn how to share power. Imagine. So that's about both personal and institutional change, changing ourselves and our relationship to power and changing our institutions and how they manage power. We are so accommodated to hierarchies that finding new ways can be difficult. But we have to help. We do have that help. We have the help of one another. We don't have to do this alone as individuals. And we also have resources to turn to. The reading that Dave gave us this morning from the Native American standpoint gives some different look at another way of seeing the world. And I've been reading some Native American authors, and they have some valuable things to offer us that could remake how we relate with others. And that's one of the keys, really, to white allyship, is having relationships with people of color, having accountable relationships with people of color. And most of that, for me, happens these days online. We have UUs of color, mostly but not exclusively, young adults who are urging us on, a group called Black Lives UU in particular. And they're part of a movement that's underway to add an eighth principle to our current seven principles. And the proposed eighth principle reads, "We, the member congregations of the Unitarian Universalist Association, covenant to affirm and promote journeying towards spiritual wholeness by working to build a diverse, multicultural, beloved community by our actions that accountably dismantle racism and other oppressions in ourselves and our institutions." Now, this won't come to this year's General Assembly, but probably will come in 2018 when it's at Kansas City. But it's not the written word that matters most, is it? It's the actions and reflections that lead us to work to dismantle white supremacy. We heard the song Amazing Grace this morning. Do y'all know the story of Amazing Grace? Did the story of that song? That song was written by John Newton. He was a slave trader. He was crossing the ocean with a cargo of slaves and reading the Bible, and was hit with the idea that what he was doing was terribly wrong. And so when he writes, "Such a wretch as me," that's what he felt like when he realized what he was doing. So that's that personal transformation. But It worked then on multiple levels, because he became an abolitionist. And he had a powerful story to tell. He wrote a powerful song and then told a powerful story and had an impact in England, where he lived, on the slave trade and the end of the slave trade. I think that reflects some of the multiple, that story reflects some of the multiple levels on which this works. And so here are some other ideas. I think we need to apply racial analysis to all kinds of problems in the world to better understand them. How does applying racial analysis affect what we understand about hunger? I think that part of our problems with our whole thing of income inequality is the images that many people have of who gets government support. So how does applying racial analysis affect what we understand about the criminal justice system? About immigration? About education? About climate change? About voting rights? About war and peace? Do we see how on all these counts, and many more, people of color are silenced and their rights disregarded, and many of the policies of our government, local, state, and federal, and this is not new since the election, have a disproportionate effect on people of color? People of color are policed instead of protected. They're blamed instead of educated. Their neighborhoods get the refuse and hazardous materials refused by others. Look at Flint or at the Dakota Pipeline. When we speak about increased repression in our country, we are mostly speaking about more of us being treated the way people of color have already been treated. So we need to raise our voices with them. And what about here in our own fellowship? We have talked about racism and anti-racism and even sent a few people to training. And I've tried to be conscious about not relying on white sources all the time for readings, but I've not opened a conversation about that with our conveners, which I commit to doing at our next convener training. If we are to understand a diverse world, we need to hear diverse voices. Many UU congregations have embraced the Black Lives Matter movement and put up banners, and we've not even had a conversation about that. And as for concrete social action, I think we've relied on the work of a few members of to carry our fellowship's name in the fight against police structures that target people by race. So we need to apply racial analysis to our own services, to our social justice work, to our forms of expression, and our ways of organizing ourselves. It's important we not make these efforts in order to make ourselves more diverse, because that's not really what it's about. And that may or may not happen with increased attention to issues. We dismantle white supremacy not to obtain the benefit of diversity so that we can feel better about ourselves, but because it's the right thing to do. And we're trying to change a culture, which has to begin with changing ourselves, because that culture has sunk into us. The Black Lives UUs have said, we want churches to say, this is who we are, whoever that is, and we commit to combating white supremacy culture out there and in here. On the personal level, we can ask ourselves what we know about race and how we learned that. Examine the feelings we have that we try to deny or hide. And we can deliberately place ourselves in more diverse and sometimes uncomfortable situations by the entertainment we choose or the causes we decide to support. We can stretch ourselves by who we make friends with. We can explore our reactions and learn about ourselves and the world. And if others would like to extend this conversation about white supremacy, anti-racism, and multiculturalism, talk to me. I'd love to find ways to make it part of our agenda. And as I said, if you're interested, I do have a resource list. If we can learn this multi-level way of addressing the issue, we can apply the same methods to many other things, to bringing peace into the world, to making the earth more sustainable, to ending heterosexism and patriarchy. I invite you now to join me in a litany by Ma Teresa Gastila Gallardo from the UU congregation of Quezon City in the Philippines, and your part is easy. After each phrase that I say, you say, when I change, the world changes. So, We are here to derive meaning in our actions.
When I change, the world changes.
We are here to win our power back over our areas of powerlessness.
When I change, the world changes.
We are here to deepen our understandings of ourselves in order to strengthen self-discipline. We are here to abolish prejudice with an appreciation for our diversity and differences.
When
we are here to feel our personal power and our capacity to affect the lives of other people.
When
we are here to become teachers to each other. We are here to spend time away from the usual influences and relearn reality. I am here to see that my singular life is a gateway to countless possibilities. Our closing hymn that I invite you to join me in now is number 119, Once to Every Soul and Nation. Please rise in body or spirit. Take courage, friends. The way is often hard, the path is never clear, and the stakes are very high. Take courage, for deep down there is another truth. You are not alone.